Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The island of Newfoundland keeps its secrets close, shrouds them in mystery. But once in a while, the fog is lifted, the truth comes out.
I get a feeling there's something going on here. My whole body was shaking.
You go to bed believing that you're a certain person one night, and then all of a sudden the next day, everything that you've known is not true.
This is not the life that I should have lived.
I'm Luke Quinton from CBC. This is Come By Chance, available now.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 12th of June, these are our main stories. War crimes and crimes against humanity. The UN's devastating assessment of the actions of both Israel and Hamas in the Gaza conflict. North Darfur's main city is on the brink of falling to Sudan's paramilitary RSF, according to the US envoy. The European Union announces plans to impose stringent new import taxes on Chinese electric cars. Also in this podcast,
this is quite transformative for research that uses human tissue to improve diseases.
New hope for people suffering from a crippling bowel disease. The conflict in Gaza, which began after Hamas attacked Israel on October the 7th, killing about 1,200 people and taking 251 others hostage, has been devastating for the territory. More than 37,000 people have been killed in the Israeli offensive since then, according to the Hamas-run health ministry, and most of Gaza has been devastated. For many neighbourhoods, all that's left is the rubble of destroyed buildings, hundreds of thousands of civilians now forced to live in makeshift camps in dire conditions. Now, a UN human rights investigation, led by the former UN human rights chief Navi Pillay, has blamed both warring sides of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. Israel did not cooperate with the UN team. Our correspondent in Geneva, Imogen Fakes, gave me more details.
It's very long and detailed reports, two in fact, one which looks at the events of October 7th and one the subsequent response by Israel. A long, long list, including the torture, murder, abduction of civilians, indiscriminate attacks on civilians by both sides. Hamas has been firing rockets into Israel. Israel has been bombing Gaza. Both sides accused of, as I said, torture and sexual violence against civilians, designed in some cases to humiliate the entire population. In addition, Israel is accused of using starvation as a weapon of war and of not only not providing the means to survive, such as food and water, which under international law would be its responsibility, but of also preventing other groups, for example, aid agencies, of doing so. So very long, detailed, very detailed report. Israel has already rejected it, saying that it just shows the United Nations what it says is systematic bias against Israel. But this report was written by a team of independent, very experienced human rights investigators, including, as you said there in your introduction, Navi Pillay.
Yeah, the accusations are among the most serious that they could have made. They weren't, though, allowed access to Israel as they were compiling this. How did they get the evidence?
Israel does not traditionally cooperate with these UN investigations because it sees them as biased. But let's not forget the prevention of UN investigators getting onto the ground where violations have occurred is not new. Syria does not allow UN human rights investigators, neither, for example, does Russia or China. But in today's modern world, it is still perfectly possible to gather evidence. The team talked to survivors and witnesses who are now based in Turkey and Egypt. These would be Palestinians. It also gathered extensive digital evidence, satellite imagery, forensic medical evidence, videos taken, including by the people, the Hamas and other Palestinian armed groups who attacked Israel on October the 7th. Quite horrific evidence, with the investigators say no doubt whatsoever in their minds. They have verified all of this, that these atrocities took place. So I would say, you know, even if an investigator can't get in on the ground, it is very possible to gather the evidence nowadays and prove that very bad things have happened, which would be violations of international law.
Imogen Folks in Geneva. Meanwhile, efforts are continuing to keep alive a ceasefire plan in Gaza, backed by the UN Security Council. Egyptian and Qatari mediators are meeting today to clarify the official Hamas response to the plan. Hamas welcomed it, but added that it still wanted a permanent end to the fighting and a complete withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. An unnamed Israeli official accused Hamas of changing key parts of the draft deal. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has arrived in Qatar to push for agreement on the latest proposal for a Gaza ceasefire and hostage release deal. Tom Bateman is at the airport in Doha.
Well, the objective here in Doha is around trying to maintain momentum for this ceasefire proposal backed by the Americans, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken will be meeting Qatari leaders here, of course, key mediators between Israel and Hamas. We had this crucial moment on Tuesday night where Hamas came back with its response to the proposal. The group said that it was positive, its response was positive, but we know that there are some of the key demands that they have always clung to. As Mr. Blinken and senior officials arrive here today, what Hamas wants are guarantees that there will be a permanent ceasefire and a full Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. Certainly in terms of what the Israelis are saying already, nothing formal, but some noises that they're seeing this as so many conditions that it effectively amounts to a rejection by Hamas of the deal. So I expect we're going to get from Mr. Blinken attempts to keep this thing afloat, crucial discussions with the Qataris during his few hours here in Doha, an attempt to maintain the momentum on this ceasefire proposal.
As we record this podcast, Mr. Blinken has been speaking at a news conference in Qatar.
Here, in a nutshell, is where we stand. A deal was on the table that was virtually identical to the proposal that Hamas put forward on May the 6th. A deal that the entire world is behind, a deal Israel's accepted, and Hamas could have answered with a single word: yes. Instead, Hamas waited nearly 2 weeks and then proposed more changes, a number of which go beyond positions that it had previously taken and accepted.
America's top diplomat, Antony Blinken. Since the war in Sudan broke out in April last year, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces have been accused of committing terrible human rights abuses in the western region of Darfur. Now, the US envoy to Sudan, Tom Perriello, has warned that the Darfuri city of El Fasher could fall imminently. But he said the Biden administration would not recognise a partitioning of the country. The RSF has laid siege to the city as it attempts to wrest its control from the Sudanese army and complete the group's hold on Darfur. The BBC's Deputy Africa Editor Anne Soy spoke to Mr. Perriello about the consequences of the attack on El Fasher.
The situation in El Fasher is horrific. We've already seen way too many civilians killed. And as bad as it is, it could get worse any day if El Fasher falls. Not only the horrors that would come from the battle, but as people flee, we've seen in earlier parts of the war where Mosalit in particular were ethnically cleansed as they were escaping situations like this. We need this to end.
And the RSF being, you know, fully in charge in Darfur, what does that mean for the conflict? What does that portend for the people there?
For the people of Darfur, it's horrific. This is really a last civilian safe haven, and we will see more refugees fleeing to Chad, which is already bursting at the seams, even more ethnic tension and tribalization of the conflict. I think if there's anyone in RSF territory who thinks taking al-Fashir means somehow they will have a right to the state of Darfur, they need to disillusion themselves of that myth. It does not mean that. We will not recognize a partition of Darfur under any circumstances.
And the international community has been criticized for not paying as much attention to this conflict as other conflicts that are going on at the moment. Is that a fair criticism?
It is absolutely a fair criticism. The world has ignored Sudan for far too long. And certainly Gaza has taken a lot of the attention. But this war was going on for 6 months before the horrific attacks of October 7th. And you still weren't seeing that kind of global attention. Some of that's about race and about treatments of Africa. Some of it's specific, I think, cynicism or skepticism about Sudan as having been a country of heartbreak.
Is this something that, you know, as U.S. envoy on Sudan, do you struggle to get the attention of people that you speak to internationally?
We do. It's been a shocking disconnect between the scale of this human crisis and the scale of attention given to it. I think the good news is that the voices of the Sudanese people have begun to be heard over the last 4 or 5 months.
What would you like to see the international community do?
Right now, what the Sudanese people need is countries around the world to demand peace and put pressure on the RSF and the SAF to come to the table and to reach a national enforceable cessation of violence. The last thing they need is more guns coming in. What they do need is more food and medicine and guarantees of humanitarian access. We need the army to agree to talk so that we can get a negotiated solution. But in the absence of that, again, we're seeing more communities start to look out for themselves. But that also means starting to take up more arms, more popular mobilization. And that, again, is something that actually makes it harder to bring this horrific war to an end.
You say you need to get the army to the talks, and General Burhan has been unwilling to come to the talks. What reasons is he giving?
Well, I'll leave it to General Burhan and others to give their rationale. What we know is we can't get the talks going without them. And so far, that rationale has changed kind of day to day. And that tends to reflect an underlying factor of simply not wanting to come to the talks. We hope that's not true. We hope that they will see the value in ending this war.
General Burhan's deputy has just been to Moscow seeking arms in exchange for setting up a naval base for Russia on the Red Sea. What do you make of that?
Well, sadly, I think it's an act of desperation, not of strength. And even if I have some sympathy for that desperation on the SAF side, it's really a recipe for extending this war, for more death and suffering of the Sudanese people. The real act of courage is to come to the negotiating table where we believe we can produce an outcome that is good for the long term of a military accountable to the Sudanese people that's professional and integrated. So this is a time for courageous leaders to see a way to a solution and to a victory for the Sudanese people.
U.S. Envoy to Sudan Tom Perriello speaking to Anne Soy. Are we about to see a trade war over electric cars between the European Union and China? The EU has announced plans to impose new tariffs on imports of Chinese vehicles, accusing Beijing of flooding the market with heavily subsidised vehicles. Taxes of up to 38% will come into force next month unless talks to find a solution in the trade dispute are successful. Meanwhile, China has already threatened to retaliate with tariffs on luxury European cars. So what effects could the tariffs have? Bill Russo is the former chief executive of Chrysler China and is now at the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai.
First of all, it'll deprioritize markets, at least for those who are expecting to export made-in-China products. It will add cost, obviously, to the market, which obviously means that consumers in those markets that are subjected to those tariffs are going to have to pay more. I think they'll pay more in general because the companies that they're designed to protect are not able to compete on price with the Chinese products. The tariffs are there to try to protect. It's a protection mechanism for the domestic industries where the tariffs are being placed. The tariffs are not coming into countries that don't have domestic auto manufacturing. So this is very clearly an effort to try to buy time for automakers who didn't prioritize EVs. It's very tough because they didn't prioritize EVs. The Chinese got there faster and with a better and more vertically integrated supply chain and more cost-effective product as a result of that. Tesla may have gotten to the EV faster, but the Chinese were ready with more affordable EV alternatives. And that's why they, and given the fact that it's the world's largest by far, 8.3 million new energy vehicles sold in China last year, 60% of the world's EV production. So China has got the super scalar potential, which drives down the ability to deliver on cost. The rest of the world just didn't prioritize EV.
Bill Russo from the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai. Scientists have taken a big step towards a new treatment for the debilitating bowel condition, Crohn's disease. It affects millions of people, many of them children. Researchers have used cells from patients to grow mini versions of their own guts, which they hope they can use to work out how best to treat every individual patient. Here's Paul Day.
Even at its mildest, Crohn's, a form of inflammatory bowel disease, can have a major impact on the lives of people who suffer from it. Camilla was diagnosed when she was 25 and has now had the condition for 6 years.
Crohn's for me has been life-changing and at times life-destroying. I've just come out of a 4.5-year flare-up. During that time, I was hospitalised at one point. I have been bedridden sometimes for weeks at a time. I've had all the symptoms that you'd expect, so severe diarrhoea, rapid weight loss, quite a lot of blood loss, pain and fatigue, sometimes so severe that I've been unable to lift my head or speak in full sentences.
Now there's hope for people like Camilla thanks to a team at Cambridge University. They've taken crucial stem cells from 160 donors, including Crohn's disease patients, and grown them in the lab to form miniature versions of each person's gut, which are described as looking a bit like cauliflowers. Crohn's is different in almost every individual. In some cases, it affects the entire gut and doesn't respond to treatment. For others, it's milder and affects only part of the gut. That's why the scientists need quite a large number of these mini-guts, or organoids as they're known, so that they can come up with a treatment that will benefit as many people as possible. Matthias Zielbauer is a gastroenterology professor at Cambridge. He says this approach is likely to be a model in the treatment of many other diseases.
This is quite transformative for research that uses human tissue to improve diseases, because the tissue that we then take, unlike, for example, animal models, are much more reflective of human disease. And they are specific for each patient, each donor from which we generate these cultures.
Professor Zielbauer and his colleagues are now testing drugs on the mini guts. The next step would be to try the drugs on Crohn's disease patients, maybe even tailoring them to each individual. The hope is that could be achieved within 5 to 10 years, resulting in a major transformation for people whose lives are currently disrupted by a disease, the cause of which is still unknown, despite decades of research.
Paul Day. Still to come in this podcast.
It's very unclear how this all started. There was no official complaint, but of course online people, you know, were saying about Danish people can't handle the spice.
Heated discussion online after Denmark recalls Korean ramen for being too spicy.
The island of Newfoundland keeps its secrets close, shrouds them in mystery. But once in a while, the fog is lifted, the truth comes out.
I get a feeling there's something going on here. My whole body was shaking.
You go to bed believing that you're a certain person one night, and then all of a sudden the next day, everything that you've known is not true.
This is not the life that I should have lived.
I'm Luke Quinton from CBC. This is Come By Chance, available now.
It is a staggeringly high number, 19 million deaths a year caused by ultra-processed foods, alcohol, tobacco and fossil fuels. That, at least, is the conclusion of a report by the World Health Organization, and it blames powerful industries which, so the report says, are trying to block government initiatives against those products. But the report has also drawn severe criticism. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes has the details.
The World Health Organization report says more than 7,400 people die every day in Europe due to harmful products and practices, and it pins the blame on four industries, those that produce tobacco, alcohol, ultra-processed foods and fossil fuels. The global picture is even bleaker, 19 million deaths per year, more than a third of all fatalities. The report says these figures don't even include deaths caused by obesity, high blood pressure, high blood sugar or high cholesterol levels, all of which are linked to unhealthy diets. But the WHO says the industries involved are actively trying to block the efforts of governments to improve the health of their populations, interfering in health policies, which it says are regularly challenged, delayed, weakened or stopped by industry. It's a controversial conclusion by the WHO. While many public health experts may agree with much of the report, it's been described as half-baked Marxism by one free market think tank.
Dominic Hughes. In the last 5 years, the Chinese government has tightened its grip on Hong Kong, clamping down on protests and free speech in the territory. As a result, many pro-democracy activists have sought asylum in the UK. But their troubles have not stopped there. Now, the authorities in Hong Kong have cancelled the passports of six activists who fled here, accusing them of endangering national security. The territory's Secretary for Security, Chris Tang, also warned others not to support the activists.
Under our suspension requirement, even they want to apply for a new passport, it won't be allowed. And as I said, it will be illegal to provide fund or to handle their fundings. It doesn't matter which platform is it, as long as they are providing funding or assisting them to handle the funding, will be subject to criminal sanction.
I asked our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton, about the significance of the move.
This is really just the latest attempt by the Hong Kong authorities to curtail the activities of some major pro-democracy activists who've chosen to leave Hong Kong and live elsewhere, but are still very much involved in speaking out for Hong Kong and trying to continue to keep the Hong Kong pro-democracy movement alive. So by cancelling their passports, it limits the ability of these six men to travel, to go overseas, to give speeches, for example, in other Western countries. They haven't gone so far as to cancel their citizenship. So they're still connected to Hong Kong. And in fact, they're wanted by the Hong Kong authorities. They have bounties on their heads of 1 million Hong Kong dollars each. That's about 128,000 US dollars. But it does limit their ability to travel unless they get some other kind of citizenship, of course.
So what have they been doing that has annoyed the Chinese authorities so much?
All six of these men have been, as I said, carrying on their activities. So they've been publishing books detailing the pro-democracy movement, speaking out for the pro-democracy movement. They've been speaking to Western media outlets and really standing up and giving voice to the pro-democracy movement. And I think the Hong Kong authorities really want to curtail the activities of these men and other exiled activists, because they want to silence their voices. They want to scare them into submission and to stop them from talking. But key, they also want to sever the ties between these exiled activists and people in Hong Kong. So the diaspora outside of Hong Kong, which is very talkative and active and eager to criticize the authorities in Hong Kong and the communist leaders in Beijing, they want to sever those ties. And the key thing that they've also done today, the Hong Kong authorities, is they've reminded people in Hong Kong that if they send any funds, any financial ties between themselves and these exiled activists by funding Patreon accounts, for example, that they themselves could be arrested by the police in Hong Kong and could face up to 7 years in prison. So they're trying to cut those financial ties as well.
Celia Hatton. Now to some heated discussion online in Denmark, because the food authorities have decided to recall different packs of spicy ramen noodle made by a Korean company. They claim the spice levels are too dangerous and could lead to acute poisoning. Liana Byrne got more from our business reporter Pierre-Antoine Denis.
It's a very strange story on a very different level. Three fiery flavors, if you want, of these Samyang instant ramen noodles, the Buldak spicy hot chicken, some other spicy hot chicken, a bit less hot, and the hot chicken stew. The quite, you know, very serious Denmark food authorities have just conducted some research and established that they were way too spicy for the levels that they allow in the country, and have asked for the products to be immediately recalled, and for anyone who have a wine possession of these noodles to return them to the stores for them to be discarded. It is believed that Sanyang was not even aware of it. They've learned it in the press. That's what we're trying to check at the minute, but this is what it seems to be.
Was there a complaint made about how spicy it was? Is that why the administrators looked into this?
That is another angle of the story that we're still looking at. It's very unclear how this all started, because there was no official complaint that has been reported. We've looked at Danish media as well, and still nothing. But of course, online people, you know, were saying about it's just normal because Danish people can't handle the spice. For them, they anything they would eat, they believe it's too spicy. What's also interesting is that Samyang Foods are the global company here. Are basically they're a multi-million dollars company. They are sending these noodles to approximately 80 countries, including the US. Many countries in Europe. I've got friends in London that are eating them on a fairly regular basis. They did tell me they were quite spicy as well. So it's not coming out of the blue. It's not a brand new product arriving into market. They have been there for a long time.
It is in plenty of different countries. I mean, that could happen to them then in other countries too.
Yes, exactly. It could happen to them in different countries. Maybe some other researchers are going to start looking into this and think, okay, this can actually be a health hazard if it's eaten in too big of a proportion.
In a statement to the BBC, the firm Samyang has said that the Danish Food Authority recalled the products not because of a problem in quality, but because they were too spicy. It's the first time the product has been recalled for this reason. Now, how long do you think you could last without your smartphone? A few hours? A day? Maybe two? Well, we followed a group of teenage college students in the north of England to see how they cope without their smartphones for 5 whole days. It's after a survey of 2,000 young people showed 3/4 of teenagers wouldn't swap their smartphone for a brick phone. That's a device that you can only use for texts and calls. Our reporter Christian Johnson was there to follow how they got on.
On Friday, I received 479 notifications.
It's fair to say some teenagers are pretty glued to their phones.
OK, guys, point of no return. Thank you very much.
But this group of students are doing the unthinkable, locking them away for almost a week.
You said your goodbye?
Yes. No TikTok, no Snapchat, no WhatsApp.
So, guys, these are your new...
Oh, my God!
Mobile phone.
Thank you.
The only way of communicating, texts and calls.
I want to knock you.
Guys, want to see something?
Mom, this is weird. I don't like it.
Oh, my God!
They're going to have to learn a whole new set of skills for the next week to be able to adapt and continue their life as close to what it used to be, but with that mobile phone underpinning most of their activities, it's going to be a real challenge.
So in the mornings, usually I'll like search up the tram times, so then I know, oh yeah, I need to leave in 5 minutes. Oh yeah, I've got a little bit of time before I need to leave. Without a phone, I've got no way of knowing when the next tram will be.
And not being involved in group chats means it's harder for Ruby to meet up with friends.
I feel like with the Nokia, I'm kind of missing out a bit more on social interaction.
But most are focusing on the positives.
Without my phone, I feel like I'm actually learning stuff and engaging more, noticing stuff around me, which I probably should be noticing anyways, but I'm just too addicted to my phone.
Usually before I go to bed, I usually just watch like Disney Plus for like an hour and then just drift off. But since then, I've just gone straight to sleep, and it's weird. I feel much better.
The more time goes on, it like becomes a lot easier to think of things to do because you've not got your phone. So like, oh, new message.
Will's mum, Alison, admits not being able to use family tracking apps like Life 360 is a hindrance, but she's noticed big changes in her son just 3 days into the detox.
It's actually quite nice seeing you without headphones for a change. I don't see you that much normally.
No.
I think it's just become the norm, whereas actual social interaction does require you to put these things away and engage a little bit more.
5 days later, it's the end of term and time to get those smartphones back.
That yours?
Yeah. Maybe I'll put my phone away in the car and I'll put my phone away like when I'm around my friends. But in general, like going on TikTok and everything, I'm still going to do that. Like, if anything, I'm going to do it more now.
I think it's been pretty difficult without a smartphone, but I've managed to get through it all right. I'll try and use less of TikTok, that's for sure. I know my screen time is quite high on that.
Judging by their initial reaction, perhaps the students aren't quite ready to give up their smartphones entirely, but the detox might start to slowly change their habits.
Christian Johnson with that report. The renowned French singer, songwriter and fashion icon Françoise Hardy has died. She was 80. Known for her distinctive voice and style, she gained international fame in the 1960s. Alice Adderley looks back at her life and legacy in French music.
Françoise Hardy was the epitome of 1960s Parisian chic, and she captivated the world with her hypnotic voice and effortless style. Born in 1944, she released her debut album in 1962 and quickly captivated audiences with her melancholic and introspective songs. Hardy's music often blended elements of folk, pop and chanson française, and her lyrics explored themes of love, introspection and the complexities of life. Hits like Tous les garçons et les filles and Le temps de l'amour remain classics to this day, and her influence on subsequent generations of musicians is undeniable. Beyond her music, Françoise Hardy's fashion sense also left a lasting mark. She epitomised the yé-yé style of the 1960s with her fringe, short dresses and simple yet elegant wardrobe. Her timeless beauty and fashion choices continue to inspire. Françoise Hardy's career spanned several decades, and she remains an iconic figure. Her contributions to both fields have left an indelible mark, making her a beloved and enduring cultural icon.
Alice Adderley. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Jack Wilfan and the producer was Rebecca Wood. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
A world of social media where there's bubbles of conflicting opinions.
All kinds of wrong and misleading information.
Conspiracy theories.
Plants for various nefarious figures.
This has changed our world.
Whose Truth is a documentary series from the BBC World Service exploring misinformation in the digital age. Join me, Babita Sharma, as I hear from the Nobel laureates and young activists trying to tackle it.
Climate refugees can also lead climate action.
Listen now by searching for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.